The Art Dealer Diaries are brought to you by Medicine Man Gallery, located for over 26 years in Tucson, Arizona. Specializing in antique Native American art, early Western art, including the famed Maynard Dixon, as well as modern art. You can find everything online at medicinemangallery.com. There's over 6,000 objects to select from. Also, the Charles Bloom Murder Mystery Series, written by yours truly, me, Mark Sublett. There's 6 books in the series, and they follow the protagonist Charles Bloom through all the intrigue of the art world set in Santa Fe and the Navajo Nation. These can be found on Audible, eBooks, Amazon, and of course, the gallery at medicinemangallery.com. Had Chris Seltzer today. He came from a show that he's doing in Santa Fe. Chris has been doing this for 50 years and one of the longest active dealers in our profession. And he had galleries in Tucson and in New York City and Santa Fe. He even went to Woodstock. So we kind of cover the entire range of his life and how he got into Native American art and the importance it had in his life and why he continues to do it. So I think you'll find this really remarkable. And we go through a lot of the old names and some of the people that were in our business that are no longer in our business because they're dead, quite frankly. And so for those who have a historic interest in how the historic Native American art really began, this is the one you would love to hear. So I had Chris Seltzer today. It's just that easy.
Well,
now we're here. We're on.
Yeah.
See, this is top notch. Oh, should I take off my glasses so I don't look like some real old guy?
Yeah.
There you go.
I hear you.
I have Chris Seltzer here today. Thank you for taking the time. You're doing a show, right, today still?
Yes. Unfortunately, the show goes Monday as well. It's been a very long week and a half. You know.
And Chris, you have a very interesting history. Besides being probably one of the older, if not, you're right in there, one of the oldest Native American art dealers still practicing their trade. You're also a farmer, which we're going to talk about, which is really interesting. So
definitely different.
Yeah, I mean, and just to kind of start, I would like to kind of hear where you grew up, because I know a lot about you in the sense that, you know, I've done business with you probably almost 30 years, but it goes way back before then.
It sure does.
I don't know where you're from. I have no idea.
Well, interestingly enough, I grew up out in the desert outside of Tucson, not too far from where your gallery
is
on Tanque Verde and Sabino Canyon Road.
That's where you grew up?
Yeah, and if you turn down Sabino Canyon heading towards the canyon, there were some little kind of subdivisions down there, the very first ones, you know, that were out and away from town. And I lived in one named Indian Ridge.
Oh, I know exactly where Indian Ridge is.
Okay.
Still there.
And
pretty good architects actually put some nice homes up in there.
Well, my mother was an interior designer, and so she designed a house and had it built in 1956. And that's when we moved to Tucson. So I was 6 and totally surrounded by desert. And as a boy, I spent all my time that, you know, when I wasn't in school, out wandering around the desert. And so I became very, very interested in, you know, desert animals, plants, reptiles, mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. And also, not too far away was a very major Hohokam ruin called the University Ruin, which after the monsoon rains, which is this time of year, August, it would strip away an inch or two of the topsoil. And so the local boys would get together and they'd go out there and we'd look for arrowheads and potsherds. And if you were really lucky, you would find a turquoise bead or a little shell fetish of some sort. And it was really just wonderful. And we had our cigar boxes and we would trade, you know, I've got 2 of these kinds of arrowheads. I'll trade you one of mine for one of yours I don't have. And of course, we also had things like pocket knives and firecrackers and marbles.
Yeah.
All the stuff that boys like, right? Yeah.
And your mom was an interior designer. What did your dad do?
My father was in the Air Force, and they had been stationed at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, mm-hmm. which is one of the big air bases in the country before I was born. And he was there, I think, in 1948 and for a couple of years. And I was born in 1950. And my mother liked Tucson so much that after my father died, he passed away when I was six.
Oh, boy. So and, that had to be majorly traumatic for you.
Well, yes. I mean, it was majorly traumatic kind of, you know, for the whole family. But because I was so young and because he was a general in the Air Force, he was not around much. And I really don't have a lot of memories of my father. And but it certainly shook things up. And
you have brothers and sisters?
I have one of each. And my brother, who's 7 years older, just passed away last summer.
Sorry about that.
And my sister's still kicking. She's 81 mm-hmm. this month. And both parents are gone, of course. I mean, and most aunts and uncles are gone, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's thinning out rapidly.
Yeah. So your mom, she had to be a working mother then.
Well, after my father died, she did. And so she actually went to school and got the ASID. It's an mm-hmm. Association of Interior Designers. Got licensed and was working for a firm in Atlanta, which is where she had grown up and where she met my father. And then shortly after that, we moved to Tucson, and she worked for a couple of different interior design firms in Tucson.
Mm-hmm.
And then kind of got tired of that. But she had a facility for languages. And my father was the he was stationed in Rio de Janeiro during World War II and was actually the air attaché attached to the U.S. Embassy. But my mother picked up Brazilian Portuguese very quick.
Mm.
And then when we got to Tucson, of course, she picked up Spanish really quick.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually ended up teaching school. When she got to be about 65, she retired.
Yeah, so she worked as a school teacher in Tucson that whole time?
Actually, she, you see, that's an interesting question. No, we moved to New York City when I was 15.
Oh, there's a change.
Yeah, tell me about it. Talk about, being dropped on another planet.
Yeah.
That was a hard adjustment, but it was a good one because it certainly broadened my scope.
Like a freshman in high school or something? Like
that? I was a junior. I was a sophomore. Uh-huh. I went my first year at Rincon High School in Tucson, and then I went to the largest public high school in New York City, five floors, and over 5,000 kids, and it was also the number one academically. Public school. So I ended up getting a very good high school education. And then after that, I moved back to Tucson to attend the University of Arizona. Started out in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Found that to be a little too dry. Very quickly, had to take some social studies requirements. Of course, took anthropology.
Right.
Very quickly found
my... I have a question, though.
Yeah.
I have a question about New York City, because that's such a pivotal point in your life. Why
it
did
really
your
was.
Mom decide to do that? Because that was a big, a big thing to do to your sister. Was she like a senior in high school? Was she?
No, she was already, she was married.
Just,
and
so it was
gone.
Just you.
She never actually moved to Tucson after our father died. She went right into college.
I see.
And never came home. And although my brother lived with us until he went to the Air Force Academy, and he left in 65. But New York was really pivotal for me because my mother would take me around to the museums.
I'm sure.
And
this
all
is
kinds
like, this is
of
a really important
art
thing.
Openings, and it expanded, my view of the world, and in particularly art and architecture, things that were of interest to me hugely. If I didn't spend those 4 years in New York City, I would have been a very different person.
I'm sure.
When I came back to Tucson and met up with some of my old friends from grade school and junior high and all that, I have to admit that I felt very sophisticated.
Yeah, you probably were.
You know,
and was this high school a high school that was, I assume, black, white, everybody with 5,000?
It was. Yeah. It sure was. And in the beginning, it was primarily there were Italian, Irish, and a lot of Jewish. A lot of the teachers were actually had doctorates. They were people who wanted to teach high school, and so they were very, very keen on the quality of education of the children, and you know, much more so, frankly, than they were in Tucson. And I just I'm so glad I had that experience, because when I came back, I did find myself to be kind of a very changed person, and in some ways, I think ahead, you know.
And at that point, did you realize that, because you start going to all these art museums, you start getting exposed that you didn't have in Tucson. You had Native American art that you could find and see.
Right.
But now you have things that you can go every weekend to the Met and that type of
and
thing.
And we did. They had lecture series at the Met, free. I think they were either Tuesday or Thursday nights. And you could go to a series by one of the leading authorities on Renaissance art or contemporary American art or ancient Roman art or
and
whatever.
You started going
all
to those
of
things.
Them.
Yeah. So you found right there you had some kind of a click with art and architecture.
Oh, yeah.
Were you drawing or painting awesome. Or doing anything yourself?
I've never been any good at it.
Yeah.
I took art lessons, and, you know, they frankly said, you know, I don't think this is for you, you know.
And at that same time, we have Vietnam going on, right? So you're about to graduate in 69. Did you go to Woodstock? I mean, that was the summer.
I sure did. It was hard because I was a lifeguard, and I had to get out of that to go up to Woodstock. I didn't know John Morris, although I certainly saw him up on the stage directing everything. And but even more interesting for me was a friend of mine went to the same high school, had gotten a job as an usher at the Fillmore East.
Oh yeah,
and
which John Morris used to.
Yeah, and so he got me a job as an usher. Bill Graham, the famous Bill Graham promoter,
right,
was not the nicest man to work for. But when you look back on it, he certainly was a pivotal figure in the rock and roll world. But we got to go backstage and, you know,
at Woodstock or at the Fillmore?
Oh, no, at the Fillmore. Yeah. I saw, you know, Hendrix and Cream, and got to hang out with Clapton and all these people. You just go back and you're on the periphery, right?
Yeah, but you see what that lifestyle is, too, which is pretty exciting for a kid who's 17 or 18 years old.
Oh, it was, and I tell some of the younger kids, you know, about all that. They're blown away. You know, it's like, I was there, you know?
Yeah. Did you consider, hey, maybe music's my thing, too, seeing all this stuff or even promotion?
Well, I hate to tell you, but I'm not any good at music either. And although a lot of people in my family are quite accomplished. Promoting, I think the promoting thing really happened when I became a businessman in the Indian business. Yeah. And that happened while I was at the U of A. And I started in 71.
Well, we're not going to let you get away from Woodstock. Everybody wants to hear about Woodstock.
You want to hear about Woodstock.
Oh, you're damn right I want to hear about Muddy. Woodstock.
The biggest thing that I remember was huge crowds, couldn't get anywhere near the stage.
Yeah.
Terrible sound because open air,
right?
And extremely muddy. It rained all the time.
And I heard the smells were pretty amazing.
Oh, it was gross. It was disgusting. It really was. I mean, you can romanticize it now, but if I had to do it over again, I don't think I'd have gone. You know, because I didn't get what I wanted. I mean, it was an interesting sociological event, you know, more than it was a musical event. Really, in essence,
I agree.
The Summer of Love and all that, right?
Right.
And so that's kind of where it was at. And then you mentioned Vietnam, and yes, I had it was either a high or a low number, whichever was worse.
Low was worse. Yeah.
Yeah. And I went to the draft board, and you know, I didn't want to go to Vietnam. I had actually been recruited by a girlfriend in my junior year of high school, whose parents were in the SDS. So I was very politically, you know, anti-Vietnam before they tried to draft me. And I was really pretty terrified about it. I had a cousin who actually went to Canada rather than go. And but it turned out I was so nearsighted. I was wearing contact lenses by that time. And I had to take them out. And you look in the little machine, and they tell you what numbers do you see? And the numbers are defined by colored dots.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And I said, I don't see any numbers. Well, what do you see? Well, it just looks kind of like a shade of purple.
Yeah.
And the guy, and I had really long hair and all that, you know, clearly I was on that, of that persuasion.
Was this before or after Woodstock, by the way, when you did your test? Do you remember?
Boy, that's close. You know what I mean? That's right. Probably after.
Yeah, I bet.
Maybe that fall.
Uh-huh.
So they said, well, you know, we don't want you. You know, you're way too nearsighted. Oh, well, the first thing they said was, we don't believe you.
I'm sure.
And, you know, and so I had to go into another room and be interviewed and, you know, okay, you know, come on, tell be honest or whatever. Thing. I said, I am being honest. And then they took my contact lenses and they had a little machine that measured the, you know, how powerful they were. And they said, oh my God, you're almost legally blind. It was -975. And I said, yeah, tell me about it. You know, I mean, you know, without my contact lenses, you're staying in somewhere else that you're not familiar with, you know, I mean, you're walking into walls and falling downstairs and all that. So,
yeah.
So I was in essence lucky to get the, whatever it was, 4F4Y, whatever.
Yeah, 4F, I think it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you get out of that, you graduate, you do Woodstock. That's kind of the summer, right?
That was such an amazing summer. Right? Yeah. The whole thing, the Vietnam thing, the Woodstock thing. I was at that age where, you know, I was involved with girls and a little marijuana, maybe. Should I say that?
Yeah, we went to Woodstock, so we'll just assume
okay.
That's the case.
So, yeah, you know, it was great. And I would say that I feel very fortunate to have sort of been almost in the center of what I think was a very, very important time in our country.
Yeah, I think so too. Especially 69. I think that year, you know, 50 years ago, which is hard to imagine.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
So
almost to the day, actually.
So I call up my friend Tommy, who lives near Albuquerque, and I said, they're having a 50th high school reunion. Do you want to go? And he said, no, I don't want to go. And he says, I don't want to see those people, you know. It was funny because he would send me pictures, you know, Facebook pictures of the hottest looking girls in high school. And
Things change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same for the boys. If you sent the boys, it would be the same thing.
Well,
it's a big wide brush.
It's kind of like that famous line from, I think it was one of the Hollywood actors on Johnny Carson. And he asked what the most embarrassing thing had ever happened to him. And he said somebody walked up to him on the street and said, didn't you used to be Burt Lancaster? Because, you know, you're always defined by when you're young and, you know, on the screen and all that.
Yeah, no, it's true. So you get through that. You survive. You don't have to go to the war. And you've decided you're going back home to Tucson, basically, to the U of A?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I wanted to go home.
And you're thinking maybe archaeology, maybe architecture, something in the arts.
Well, I started out in architecture very quickly.
Uh-huh.
You know, switched to anthropology as my major. Did some archaeology. Didn't really like digging up things that much. Really started more interested in cultural anthropology. Very interested in ethnolinguistics. You know, things that were sort of what you would call define culture. What is culture? Mm-hmm. What, you know, in a humanity sense, that was to me a lot more intriguing than archaeology. You know, and I mean, I like archaeology and I like to study the, you know, prehistoric cultures, but it just didn't have enough living human sort of energy for me. Yeah.
And so, did you get your degree in that?
Yeah, I actually went. I got a BA, and then I went to graduate school
in Tucson as well.
In Tucson, mm-hmm. The U of A, and 1974.
And did you get a master's also then?
Never quite, almost.
And what stopped you? Something probably got in the way.
Yeah, something did. I opened a shop on
Speedway. Yeah, that's what I want to hear about.
Speedway and Park, right next to the university.
So when did you...
Now been bulldozed and made into a parking lot, of course.
So when did that happen, that you started to buy Native American material and sell it? Because you just don't go, I'm going to open a shop. Something happened during that college time.
No, I wanted to collect. Mm. And I didn't have any money. But I did have some knowledge and a reasonably good eye. And back in the early 70s, that would go a long way. So if it went to flea markets and, antique stores and estate sales, and on the weekends or on vacations, I would go out on the res and hit all the trading posts. And I knew when all different pond was coming dead. And
so up on the Navajo mainly.
Up on the Nav, of course, which, that doesn't exist anymore. I mean, they're all Navajo owned. But back in those days, if you got out and moved around a lot, you could find a lot of very interesting stuff. And it hadn't, the Indian thing in terms of being what was fashionable, hadn't caught on yet. And so it was really a fairly small group of people who had a serious interest in the material. Mm-hmm. And then starting with, I guess it was 73 or so, Arizona Highways started coming out with issues on Indian arts and crafts. And, first it was a generalized issue and it was received so well. Then they did one on just jewelry and then one on pottery and, and baskets and so on. This went on for a few years. Well, it just, all of a sudden, the market just boomed and everybody was into it. And all the Hollywood people were wearing squash blossoms and concho belts. Jim Morrison.
Yep.
I went to a Doors concert in New York and he was wearing a concho belt, And you had Cher wearing the big squash blossom.
I often wondered who sold Jim his piece.
It wasn't me, I regret to say, But
it was a good one too. It was a really good
product. And Hendrix had a nice one too. And there was a guy on Madison Avenue in New York that had kind of a cowboy thing, and there were a lot of people sort of into dressing the cowboy look and kind of midnight cowboy sort of thing.
Yeah, that's about right.
Really. Yeah. And then, of course, he got into the I used to sell to him. See, my mother was still living in New York.
You used to sell to who?
The guy on Madison Avenue, and I honestly can't remember the name of the shop, but and a whole bunch of other places started selling Indian jewelry. Mm-hmm. So I would go out, I'd go to like Gallup and buy a whole bunch of these hideous squash blossom necklaces, and they cost me $125 a piece. And I'd fill up an attaché, still have the same attaché, with them, fly to New York. That was before... You could do that. Just get on an airplane.
I think that
guy's
name was Sadie, wasn't it? Something like that.
Well, there is that guy.
Yeah.
He actually had something near kind of the Trump Tower, FAO Schwartzery.
But this was a different person.
Yeah, I knew him too. But he was kind of a contemporary guy with mostly Zuni. He loved Zuni.
Yeah,
stuff.
That's right.
And but I ended up, developing accounts with Bloomingdale's and Saks and Bergdorf's and all that.
How did you do that?
I just walked in there with an attaché
full of
stuff.
These squash blossoms?
Okay. So I'm wholesaling these things to them for $375, and I paid $125. So I'm tripling my money, and they're selling them for $1,200 and something. So they're tripling or quadrupling the price on this stuff.
And this was Bergdorf's? Where else?
Oh, Saks, Bloomingdale's, plus, I was selling to that guy on Madison Avenue, and he was the only one that actually had any old stuff. And he loved, like, the Zuni cluster bracelets, the big, flashy stuff,
And is this 73-ish?
Yeah. And those things hit a price point they've never returned to. I mean, at one point, I was paying $600, wholesale for one of those things, and they were going for $2,400 in the shops.
And you could still take that $600 one and up to New York and sell it for $1,200.
Yeah, that's about it. The markup has never been as high, it was on the contemporary.
Right,
contemporary was how I made money to finance my collecting, and then opened the gallery with my collection in 1974.
Yeah, and that boom kind of, it was pretty a short boom, really. It was like, by 75, it was kind of...
I shut the gallery down and I think I made it to 78.
Yeah. So 74, you open it.
Yeah.
You go, okay, if I'm doing this well in New York City, I can kick it here too, and I don't have to make the trips every to the reservation and go all the way back to New York.
And the interest in the antique or the older American Indian stuff, a lot of the people that got interested in the contemporary stuff became interested in the older stuff. And they often start that way. And so there was a burgeoning market for the older jewelry, older pottery, older blankets, and what have you. And by 78, the walk-in traffic, the amount of business I was doing out of the shop had decreased to the point, and I had developed a clientele of people for the older stuff, which is what I was personally interested mm-hmm. in. I didn't need a shop anymore. You know, I had a really good stable of collectors that I could, you know, just call up and say, I've got a such and such, and, mm-hmm. you know.
And that
virtually sell it over the phone.
Suited your personality maybe a little better, instead of sitting in a shop 8 hours a day.
Exactly. I don't have the patience for it. And I've had 4 or 5 different gallery shop venues. And my last one on Upper Canyon Road in Santa Fe, actually it was on Canyon Road, but the upper part of Canyon Road. You do get tired of people coming in and asking to use your restroom or, you know, where is such and such a restaurant right. or whatever.
And did you make all this?
And how do you know it's old?
Yeah.
And I had what I called the 3-step rule, which was most people would be 1 or 2 steps. They'd look around. It didn't compute. They'd turn around and walk out.
Yeah.
They made it 3 steps. There was a chance that they actually, their curiosity would uh-huh. kick in, you know. Yeah. And I did meet a few really wonderful people who said, wow, well, you know, this stuff, I thought it was only in museums and, you know.
Right. You have to have the 3 steps and the stool. So then when they sit down, that's when you know you're,
yeah.
you always have somebody you can talk to who has interest. Yeah.
And, which I love. I love to talk to people who have interest.
Yeah, we all do.
I don't have much patience for the public at large. I admit that.
That's okay. It leaves room for us. So you close it in 78?
78.
Okay, but you stay in Tucson?
Yeah, I stayed in Tucson for a couple more years, mm-hmm. and then one of the other gallery owners that I did a lot of business with, Lee Cohen from mm-hmm. Gallery 10 in Scottsdale, had met some people in New York who had a gallery called ACA Gallery, and they dealt in, originally, it had been... WPA sort of stuff mm-hmm. and in the 30s, and then they expanded. They were handling a lot of different things and quite successful, and the sons of the owner were really interested in, really loved the American Indian material, and so the idea sort of came together, well, what about a gallery in New York? And Lee and the Bergens and Jerry Collings was one mm-hmm. of our partners. We all said, well, who can we find who's going to be foolish enough to go to New York and
sit
and run this gallery?
Right.
And I thought, well, you know, they said, oh, hey, you know, would you be willing to do this? And I said, well, it depends. You know, I said, first of all, I want a big salary. Mm-hmm. and commissions, and I want to be a partner. And they agreed to all of that. And so I knew New York very well.
That's a big helpful thing.
And I knew my way around. And I understood, you know, kind of how New Yorkers think and how to do business with them and what have you. And so I went to New York. And
this was 1980?
1981.
Yeah, so you're 31.
I'm 31. And there was a big recession in 82.
Yes, there was.
If you've been on the planet long enough, you'll remember that. Bad timing. Because the very first place that people stop spending money is New York.
Yeah.
You know, Wall Street. And so we were, basically getting in the red. And the first year was pretty good. And then in 82, it all just came to a screeching halt. And but the overhead didn't. And we had an overhead at that time over 30,000 a month. And in 82, and you can imagine what that would be today. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was getting gray hairs and, you know, at mm-hmm. age 32, really stressful. And so it just, we finally got to a point where we said, you know, enough is enough. We've all lost enough money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it just isn't happening. And so we closed it down. And see, I came to Santa Fe in 85. So it was probably 84 or so. It lasted a couple of years, 2 to 3 years. And that was it.
And what did that experience, do you think it changed the way you looked at Native arts? Because you're looking at it at that point more as a fine art, I assume.
Well, that was part of the agenda, was to take it to New York and present it, you know, along with African and pre-Columbian and other areas of tribal art that were already accepted mm-hmm. as being, you know, collectible within the fine art community. And I think there was some success in that. But one of the lines that I got an awful lot from people who had became really good clients of mine was, oh, well, we want to go to Santa Fe to buy it.
Right. We want to go to the source, basically.
Yeah. And it's part of the experience. You go back to New York and people say, well, where'd you get that, you know, beautiful pot? And you say, well, I got it in Santa Fe.
Right.
You know? And, so I scratched my head and I realized, I can sell to these people, but not in New York.
And not have to pay $30,000.
Yeah.
Not yet, at least.
I mean, the ones that became really knowledgeable and serious collectors, I could do business with anywhere. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. But those people that you wanted to cultivate, much better to cultivate them here mm-hmm. than there.
Yeah, and plus you're a Southwest boy.
Yeah.
And so what was Lee Cohen like? I mean, I dealt with Lee. I sold him some stuff. And I knew Phil, of course, very well. Phil's mm-hmm. now selling real estate in Costa Rica. Hey, Phil.
Is he really?
Yeah, he is.
He's not doing Pilates anymore.
I don't know if he does that too. He may. He's very good at Pilates.
It's funny about Costa Rica because we have a place in Costa Rica.
Oh, yeah.
I love Costa Rica.
I actually even did one summer with Phil. We did, I rented out part of the space on Canyon Road, which was fun. But, you know, what was Lee like? Because for those who don't know, I mean, he was the top dog really in, you know, Native American arts, both contemporary and deceased, you know, antique. And he was in Santa Fe and Scottsdale and for a period also New York.
Yes. And that's right. In fact, Lee took over our gallery space in New York and ran it as one of the Gallery 10 locations for, I don't know, a year or two. And Phil went up there and moved to New York, where he met his previous wife and ran that gallery. And then came down here and they had a little gallery at 225 Canyon Road, which you might remember.
Yep.
Getting back to Lee, Lee was, I think Lee was a difficult person, very demanding. I remember one time I called him up and I was so excited because I had sold to a brand new person, like I think it was $125,000 worth of Indian material. And Lee's response was, well, why wasn't it $250,000? Yeah. And I said, I'm working on it. You know, so yeah, he was very driven.
And he came from the business world, right?
He was the president of Allied Structural Steel in Chicago. He married the boss's daughter, Adele Cohen, and so the moved out. Had some health problems in his 50s and moved to Scottsdale. And that's when he acquired what had been the Ashton Gallery in Scottsdale, Ashton, which was previously the premier flagship American Indian Gallery. So Lee took that over. And then at that time, there were a number of galleries in Santa Fe, typically smaller spaces, quite a few of them. The first real flagship gallery in Santa Fe was Morningstar Gallery. Mm-hmm. And
though Dewey might say, Ray Dewey's was
a very small space.
Yeah, but he had really great quality.
Oh no, I mean, I'm not talking about quality. I'm just talking about that sort of presence.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
You know, but yeah, no, Ray was one of the great dealers. He became partners with John Coffrin, who had the Kaibab shop in Tucson.
Yeah, I knew John.
And John wanted me to do Santa Fe with him. And I said, no, I went to New York instead. So Ray ended up being the guy. Yeah.
And Ray,
did I make a mistake there?
Yeah, Ray Dewey did really well.
So. Yeah.
So, but Lee, he was demanding, but did he have the knowledge? He sure had the followers, that's for sure, of the material.
Lee was a salesman, a very good salesman. He had enough knowledge. He was not a scholar. He always used to call me the professor. And, you know, but he had Jerry Collings, who was somebody who'd been around a long time and had been the director of the Pima Museum in, was it Sacatone? Mm-hmm. But, you know, between Phoenix and Tucson, was an acknowledged expert on basketry.
Yes. Still is.
Still is. And they became good friends, and he learned a lot from Jerry, especially about baskets. And then Dick Howard, who was worked for the National Park Service as a ranger at Casa Grande National Monument, was very knowledgeable in pottery, and so Dick was a resource close by. And there were a number of people, and we were all very good about sharing information. You had Pueblo One with the Cleland brothers, really nice, and once again, a really fine American Indian shop. You know, and then there were the other places that were a little more tourist oriented, you know, but, you know,
so he utilized his resources
very well.
Yeah. Which is in a business and a big business that you had done. That's what you do, right? You get the best you can.
Yeah.
And you let them do the vetting and then you do what you do, I guess.
Yes, exactly. You know, Lee was always wanting to close the sale and he was good at it.
Yeah, it was a very successful gallery. Yeah. And because of that, they got the best material too.
Yes, they did. I mean, they had great, great stuff. And, you know, you don't see that level of quality anymore. It just...
Except at Medicine Man Gallery.
Except at Medicine Man Gallery.
No, it's true. It's really not true. Out there. There's hard to find that kind of stuff.
And what came out of the woodwork when the prices started climbing and you had the older generation of people that collected it or their children who weren't interested in it, it sort of came out and got absorbed into the marketplace. And so now a lot of the better things or just things in general have been in the private sector. And they come back around as people decide they're getting older or their children aren't interested. So there's, you know, the secondary market is one of the major sources of material these days. Very little really good stuff comes out of the woodwork anymore.
Yeah, very, very, yeah, it's rare. And so you, when you come back from New York, you go, I'm going to do Santa Fe. Is that right?
Yeah.
And so do you set up a shop at that time?
Yeah, I came out and the first thing I did was buy a house.
That was actually a smart move.
Oh, it was one of my smarter moves. Yeah. And then I started buying old Adobe fixer-uppers on the east side of Santa Fe. And that turned out to be very profitable when you could find them there. Once again, it's something that you can't do anymore.
Right. And
I was able to kind of recover from the New York experience because being a partner in that, the amount of money relative to one's net worth affected me much more. I really came to Santa Fe because I was almost broke.
Mm.
And I had left Tucson in pretty good shape. So, but I was fortunate. I was definitely, I wish I'd come a little earlier, but things were happening. And we had a lot of really fine dealers like Ray Dewey.
Is this like about 1984?
85.
Okay.
And that next 5 years was great. And I was able to, you know, rebuild a wonderful collection. And I got married, you know, so on and so forth, you know.
And so when you're buying and selling these houses, you buy the old Adobes, fix them up and sell them? And you were also still buying and selling native arts as well?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Then did you start a gallery, or did you just do it all privately?
I'm trying to think what my first semi-gallery experience in Santa Fe was I rented a room in Sena Plaza, which is one of the great downtown historic buildings, and it was upstairs, and so it was kind of a destination place, and I didn't see a lot of public people, but when people came to town, they'd come see me, and I had great stuff, great blankets and pots and all of that, and I liked the fact that it was I didn't have to deal with the public at large.
Yeah. So it was almost a private office with high-end
exactly
material.
And I like that formula a lot. And there are other dealers who have done similar, like Mac, you know, and other people who, you know, who gave up the public gallery. And,
yeah, that's Mac Grimmer who used to have a gallery.
Because once you're established and once you have, you know, a good clientele, that's just not all that necessary. And, you know.
And so you do that for a long time, right?
Yeah. Well, then I had a little space in what's now Shiprock.
On the plaza. I don't know if I ever went to that space.
When Ray Dewey moved from upstairs, when he split up with Nat Owings, it was Owings Dewey, then it became Dewey. He took over that space. When he gave that up, myself, a couple other dealers took it over. It was a little kind of a small consortium.
Was that the Throckmorton?
Throckmorton, Dale, Channing, and then myself.
Yes.
And Throckmorton pulled out. Actually, that's when I got involved. It was when Throckmorton pulled out. And Billy Siegel came in for a while. And it was kind of an interesting experience. And that went on for a couple of years.
There's a story there. He glossed over.
There's a lot of stories. you and I could be here for days.
Okay.
Literally.
You got time.
The logistics, the demographics of the business is intriguing in itself. I got out of that and I swore I'd never do a shop again. And of course,
was part of that just kind of trying to, because of all the different personalities and the dealers and the material, trying to work all together in the same spot was hard?
Yes.
I would think so. Yeah, because they're all strong personalities.
And there's always issues, you know. I could tell you some stories, but it would be probably not. Get me in trouble with some of the other partners in the space.
Yeah, they're all alive. So,
I got out of there, then I opened that little shop on Canyon Road, up at 830 Canyon Road, and I was there for a few years, and that was a nice little spot because it didn't get a lot of traffic, and the rent was very reasonable because it wasn't in the high.
Yeah, and it was a pretty space
district.
Too.
Yeah, and then the landlord decided he was going to raise the rent. A lot, and I said no, and so then I left that space, and decided I would never do retail again. And then I got involved in 2014 with one of my favorite historic buildings close to the plaza, at 136 Grant, and I'd always loved that building.
Yeah,
always wanted a space
building.
In there. And when I had an opportunity to get the salon, the main room, you know, and it was a collective. So there were, 8 or 10 different
right, but good quality.
Rooms, different dealers. So I did that. I started that in 14, and that was very good for the first couple of years. And then the third year, combination of factors, but it no longer was profitable, and I decided that back to private dealing.
And so you're out of that one now. You're just doing private.
I swear to you, Mark, I'll never do retail again.
Well, you might not, because you took something else up, and we'll get into that.
Okay.
Maybe now this is the right time to talk about
all
it.
Right.
I'm going to go back and ask a few other questions, but at some point, not too long ago, you go, I think I'm going to be a farmer.
Well, it wasn't even quite that. It was sort of like that. In 2014, a client who'd been familiar with our house, which was on the east side of Santa Fe, old adobe off of Upper Canyon Road.
This is the same one you bought when you came back from New York?
The first house we bought was in the same neighborhood, but smaller. And then when I got married, I bought a bigger house and also remodeled that one. So it was all in what they call the Barrio de Cristo Rey, which was all centered around a church, Cristo Rey Church, which had been remodeled by John Gaumeem, who's a famous local architect in the 30s or something. And at any rate, I forgot where I was going.
So your client said, you have this house, house, and you did a trade?
He said, if you're interested in selling, I'd like to buy it. And so we thought, well, here we are, and I still had a big mortgage payment. The market wasn't terribly good at that time.
The collective's kind of stopping.
And the collective is sort of, not so great. My wife, who had grown up on a farm in Minnesota, very much wanted to sort of go back to her roots. I grew up out in the desert, so the idea of getting out of town, doors was appealing to me. And it had been, it was an old, old farm the house dates back to about 1850. And it has an ancient apple orchard on it. It's about 5 acres. It goes from the border with San Ildefonso Pueblo land. And then on top of the hill, the highest point's the house. And then there's huge cottonwood trees, an acequia, a pond.
Wow.
And then three terraces of fields going down to the Pewaukee River. So it went all the way from the river to the... And it was the original sort of hacienda house up there, because it was at the high point. We had amazing 360-degree views.
And you see Black Mesa, I assume?
Yeah, Black Mesa, right? and the Jemez and the canyons of Jemez and the Sangres and the Barrancas, those dry hills, and Truchas Peaks and everything.
Yeah.
Plus, you look down, you look south and into this big bosque, so it's kind of got everything. And we saw it, and I said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the farming part has been, it's a hell of a learning curve.
I bet, yeah.
And a lot of work physically. And I'm 68 years old, and I was 64 when we started farming. And I love it. I'm probably in the best physical condition. I'm at the same weight, what I weighed in high school. Mm-hmm. But I definitely have a lot of aches and pains.
Yeah.
And you're on your hands and knees, and it's hard work. And on one hand, it's very rewarding, but sometimes it's very frustrating. Like our tomato crop got wiped out by some weird fungus thing that came in, and we'd had incredible tomatoes the previous few years. It kind of reminds me of Pearl S. Buck and The Good Earth, if you ever read that book, where the Chinese farmer becomes very successful, and then the locusts come and wipe them out, right? And
you know
back,
what a farmer
he's back
like.
To square one,
Yeah. And what do you grow? Besides, do you still have apples?
Oh yeah.
So apples and what else?
The apples. Some of the apple. It had been an experimental apple orchard, and so some of the apples are awful, and some of them are incredible.
Mm.
So we know which trees are which, and the awful ones we just give them to pigs and goats or whatever, right? Or compost. And the other apples we sell, or we can a lot. We can a lot of. We make a lot of applesauce. We freeze apples.
Yeah, because you're selling this stuff. I mean,
yes.
It's a real farm. This is not just...
We can't consume everything that we make. And so we're doing the farmer's market.
Here in Santa Fe?
The one in Santa Fe. We've been doing it since we started producing. So that would be almost 5 years now. And it's fun. It's interesting. You're up at 5 o'clock in the morning and packing up. You have to be there by 6:30. And we're selling a lot of different vegetables, everything, from tomatoes to carrots, to beets, to cucumbers and, eggs, on everything.
Do you eggs? Do you do eggs for your, from your chickens?
We do. We sell eggs. We have quail, and we sell quail eggs. We sell melons. We have wonderful melons that we raise. Gosh, I'm trying to think. It's pretty extensive.
Yeah, so it's a real farm.
It's a real farm.
You have a tractor?
Well, I don't, and I do have a tiller.
Yeah,
and all kinds of other machinery.
Yeah,
and I don't have a tractor. Two reasons. One is they're unbelievably expensive.
No, I know they're.
And secondly, getting a tractor means you're really, really committed.
Yeah, no.
And my wife is pushing hard. She wants to develop one of the lower fields, and you know, that's tractor time. So yeah.
And so you must have clients that come through there that you're, you know, you're selling these great blankets and wonderful, you know, native material, and then you, they go to the farmer's market and they see you there. That's had to happen.
Usually don't recognize me wearing a different hat, so to speak.
Big farmer's hat.
Yeah, right. You know, or a Carhartt, you know, bill cap. And no, it's really funny. And a lot of them are kind of like really taken back. It's sort of like, Chris, is that you? You know, it's like, you know, you're farming. You know, wait a minute. You know, why are you farming? Yeah. That's hard work. And you don't make money farming.
Yeah.
And you do it, it's a labor of love, and it gives you something to do. I always, like you, I'm sort of like to really be intensely involved in whatever it is I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And farming definitely fits that definition.
Yeah.
And so, but yeah, it's really funny. You know, some clients came, would come through and they go to farmer's market, and you know, I mean, I hope they don't think that I've fallen on such hard times that, you know, I don't have a, you know, an old coffee cup on the front of the table, you know, for donations. But
it happened to me too. You know, people would come into the gallery and they see their physician is throwing rugs and wondering what's going on there. So that happened for a little bit when I was doing both things. But
yeah, well, that's pretty. That, those are pretty separate professions,
yeah, exactly.
As well. And most of them are really impressed by it. Most of them think it's great.
I'm super impressed, actually.
A lot of them, you know, the idea that you just sort of sit around and buy something for X and then sell it for 2X, you know, and you don't really do anything, you know, it was kind of like the, you know, like you were part of the, you know, in, you know, a trust funder or something, which was certainly not the case. Neither one of us. But I know both of us made our own money and worked our way up. But that image sort of sticks with it because it's kind of the artsy, bon vivant, dilettante sort of image. And there was a rumor going around that I was the Coca-Cola heir.
Never heard that one.
No?
No.
Didn't. Not true.
No. I heard it was Dr. Pepper, actually.
Well, then somebody said Pepsi.
No, I never heard of it. I always knew you worked hard.
Seltzer water, maybe, right?
Well, you know, if you're at all these shows, and you always do the show, you're doing one right now, and you have for 40 years, I guess, probably from the beginning. Didn't you kind of do these shows from the beginning as well?
Yeah, the first Don Bennett show, White Hawk show, was at the Hilton Hotel.
Right.
And you had an option of doing, you know, the ballroom being set up there, or they had rooms, corridors of rooms off of that. I always went for a room, you know, because then when people come in, it's more one-on-one. If I had to make one criticism of the shows is that it's sensory overload for a lot of people, and they get to a point whereby they can't process all the stuff. And I don't know that I prefer to have a one-on-one venue when you can really talk to people about it and develop a, you know, some kind of a relationship with them.
So you are, again, one of the longest continuous dealers in this profession. So you have a very good vantage point, I think, more than others, to see what the changes have been. And I'd like to get that insight of what you've seen that.
Yeah, the attrition rate has been, as you know, recently we've lost a few more of the important Jimmy Economos, Jimmy Hart. I mean, it goes on and on. Every year increases, of course. I mean, as we get older. And I've seen it since really it's, I guess what I would kind of call its inception. There were shows. There was a show at the Metropolitan Museum in the 40s, and there's even a little catalog to it, quite wonderful, of Native American stuff. So, you know, there have been other attempts to sort of promote it as being worthy of inclusion and as great as a great artistic cultural traditions. But the thing that really launched it, and I was there, was a sale at Sotheby's in 1971 and 72 of a collection of a guy named Colonel Green. And my mother was still living in New York City at the time. So I just went, you know, I stayed with my mother and I went to the sales and I met some of the really famous. I met Jimmy Economos there. I met George Terasaki. There are a number of other people that are no longer with us. But the real, the people who really created the market, were there, and a lot of them had started in the 60s. And I think that, you know, it's kind of the, I think an interest in tribal cultures and looking outside of our own culture for aesthetic and artistic inspiration started really in the 60s. Vietnam War actually exposed a lot of people to other cultures, especially Southeast Asian cultures. So it started then, I think, really, you know, for Americans. Europeans had been involved for a long time because they were the colonial peoples in all these countries. But in 1971, the Green Sale was the first time Sotheby's actually, it was two sales. One in late 71, the other one in early 72, they actually did a color catalog, you know. And boy, that just, that was it. I mean, that was a pivotal moment for me. I'm there and I'm going, hey, this is what I want to do, you know. And I'm in school, U of A, I'm still an undergraduate.
Like a junior.
Yeah. And I thought, wow, you know. And so when I went back home and back to Tucson, then that's when I really started pursuing it aggressively.
So really, it was that auction.
Yes.
That was the pivotal point. And it's because you could see it as a fine art.
Yes. And you know, things were, there were some really wonderful things in that sale. And they were bringing, for the first time, you know, serious five figures, which would be today would be serious six figures, you know, like there was an incredible Washoe basket, Skies Bryant, which sold to a New York collector, and it sold for like $6,000. That was unheard of. And I ended up getting that basket from that man and reselling it for, you know, many years later for $30,000. Wish I had it back.
You think it's worth more now at this point?
Yeah, that's a tough market, but one of those, something of that level, yeah. I mean, the handful of collectors that have the wherewithal would definitely step up for that. Yeah.
So you, that pivotal sale was really a change, and it affected you.
Me very much, but it was also affected a lot of other people
because other people saw it.
And then, as I said, shortly after that, you had the, you know, the Arizona highways thing happening starting around 73. And it just seemed like boom, boom, boom. Oh, and I don't want to forget to talk about Sacred Circles.
Okay.
Sacred Circles was a major show of American Indian art at the Nelson Atkins Gallery in Kansas City. And the director was a man named Ted Coe. And Ted Coe put this show together. It's a catalog that's almost an inch thick. It was the definitive reference for Native American art. And this show, in 76, so once again, we still have this sequence of events. Every year or two, something major happening. And that further expanded the awareness and the market for Native American 2 years later, you had the Chicago Art Institute did a similar kind of show. Also wonderful, very thick reference. Those two catalogs are kind of the Bible, if you will, of references for a Native American. And then a lot of other shows and happened after that in different museums, different venues. A lot of books came out on the subject of
America. And you wrote a book.
And I wrote a book. Yeah. It was published in 1985 on Navajo weaving. And it just snowballed.
And at some point, though, things have changed a little. And that's kind of, I'd like to get that perspective. Because what was going on then with all the books coming out, and there still are, see a lot of... I know when I started, there really wasn't anything much. There was a few things, Dillingham's mm-hmm. book, Batkin's book on pottery, those kind of things. Yeah. But you really had to look. Now there's a plethora of them, which is fantastic for those who are interested. They have YouTube videos and all that. But it seems like the market itself has changed fairly dramatically since 2009, after the big recession, depression. Have you seen that kind of change, or for what you deal in and kind of the higher end?
It seemed like the market would kind of go through these 5-year cycles mm-hmm. where a downturn would be triggered by a Wall Street recession. And then it would come back, and then it would go down again and come back. But each time it came back, it usually would come back a few notches higher.
Mm-hmm.
After the 2008 real estate bubble thing and all that, which affected everybody and everything in a way I'd never seen before in my lifetime, the market has never really recovered fully from that.
And that was at the height that we must admit.
Yes.
2008 really was
height absolutely.
Of the value of things.
Well, yes. And I think that the upper middle class, I used to have a lot of clients that were doctors and lawyers, professional people, successful businessmen, mm-hmm. Seems to have diminished greatly. Those people do not have the same disposable income that they did back then. And so now the market has become more polarized, and so it's affordable decorative stuff or great stuff at astronomical prices that's selling to one percenters.
I wonder if any of that has to do with the rate of the college education, what it costs, that middle class now, just all their money goes to the colleges for their kids.
It's probably the greatest problem our country faces.
Yeah, it really is a problem.
Is the educational system. And after World War II and the GI Bill and during Vietnam, I was on the GI Bill because my father died during the Korean War. So that I went to college, the government paid for it.
Now I use the GI Bill for when I went to my residency.
Yeah. So, a lot of people I know who are doctors and lawyers, they got their degrees because of that. They became who they were. They would not be able to do that today unless their parents could spend $40,000 to $50,000 a year for college. That's a lot of money, and I think you're definitely seeing a lot fewer people that should go to college, that want to go to college, that are not able to do so. I have a the son of a good friend of ours got an architecture degree at Columbia. He's going to be paying off that loan till he's 50 years old.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Maybe he needs to go into the Indian art business. Well, you know what? Young people.
We need them.
And they can run this business. There's some great opportunities, not only for historic material, but contemporary material. And
the contemporary market seems very healthy.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the contemporary artists, about the first time I ever saw contemporary material selling for more than antique material was that sale of Marshall Miller's collection mm-hmm. at Sotheby's. And he had important, like Margaret Tafoya's, Maria's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you were, as was I. And it was the first time I saw the contemporary market bringing higher prices than the antique material.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that trend has actually continued.
Yeah, I think so.
What was that? It had to be at least 10 years ago, 15 years
ago.
Yeah,
more like 15,
yeah.
Probably.
And which is great for contemporary American Indians. And, you know, I'm really happy for them, you know. And I have a number of very close friends who are contemporary American Indian artists. And it's nice, like Tony Abeda
right.
is one of my good friends. And tremendous, probably the most successful, I think, don't you? Maybe.
For Tony,
right
you
there.
Mean?
Yeah.
He's up there. There's
yeah.
no doubt about
yeah.
it. I mean, there's some other individuals that are in the, that we might not even know that are in the contemporary world that,
yeah.
That sell in New York City and things like that, that really actually
bring I have to admit, I'm not that familiar with it.
Yeah. So, yeah, this has been fun. Is there anything you want to leave as a little tidbit for those out there listening?
Well, I'd like to say that people like you and I and a handful of others got involved with the American Indian material because we loved it.
Yeah.
Not as a way to make a fast buck or an easy buck, because it isn't.
No.
And I think in the media, and there's a false perception that we profit excessively at the expense of past generations of Native Americans. And while I'm sure there are examples and abuses, I think as a general rule, I don't think that's true. And I think starting in 1885, when the railroad came through, all the Indians that had access to the railroad or the trading post, what have you, started producing things for sale to
yep.
non-Indians. And so, and that's 95% of what you and I handle in the old
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe and even more, maybe even more like 99%.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and of course, having a background in anthropology and having grown up in the Southwest and having spent a lot of time on different reservations and all that, I think that I have a much better knowledge of the what I would just call the historical truth or facts. Now, that may not be a popular thing to say among certain segments, as you and
yeah.
I know.
But that's why we do this
yeah.
podcast, so people can hear
yeah.
all about our business,
yeah.
what we do, why we do it. You know, you spend 50 years doing this.
Yeah, I know.
So and there must be some reason you want to do it.
If I had to say one final thing, I'd say I feel so fortunate to have been in the place I was at the time I was, that this just unfolded for me. You know, it was something I loved, and I was able to turn it into a way of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a wealthy person. There was never really an opportunity to become wealthy, except for George Terasaki, of course. but, you know, some of the guys who collected heavily in the 60s did become wealthy because they had great collections that they sold. But I can't really think of anybody that I would say is really, truly wealthy
right.
that we've, you know, come along with. And it's a labor of love.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And I'm so happy that I was part of it.
Well, Chris Seltzer, thank you for your labor of love on the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. And I'll let you get back to going and selling today to the public.
Hopefully.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what it is, you know.
Yeah.
Hopefully somebody will come in and spend some money or at
yeah.
least enjoy what you have. And they will, because I
yeah.
saw your booth. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
Chris
thank
Seltzer,
you
very sure. good. I want to get some thank of your you, tomatoes on your next year, because it
you
sounds
got it.
Like your crop this year is gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately. Next
right.
year. You're
Chris
in.
Seltzer.
All right.